Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hi, it's Martin Ware here. Electronically Yours, as always. Today's episode features a good old friend of ours from our days back in Soho and Top of the Pops, etc., from the 80s. Steve Norman from Spandau Ballet. He's a super nice guy, very talented, and heartwarming stories about his relationship with the rest of the guys from Spandau and the fact that they all grew up together at school, met at school. And we are very close whenever we meet. You know, we've been through similar experiences together. We all came from kind of the clubbing scene in Soho, and we go into detail on that and about his new work and everything. So here he is. Steve Norman. So, tell us about growing up in Stepney.
I didn't. That's a Wikipedia false thing, because that's where I was born. My mum, lived, and my dad lived in King's Cross area. She grew up around King's Cross, where, you know, sort of war child, really, and evacuated from the area, and then went back. So it was never that far from, say, Holborn, Angel Islington, where I went to school, as did the rest of Spandau. I lived on the Bourne Estate in Clerkenwell, at the other end of Gray's Inn Road.
Right.
And still, you know, for a long time, went to school there. Met, of course, school was in Angel Islington, and I knew Gary was in my class. So all the Spandau boys come from Dame Ellis
Owen
Grammar School. 1971, 11, when we went there.
Right.
So, so that was my manor, and in London it still is, to be honest with you, although I don't go to London so much now. It's changed since I was a kid, not for the worse, just, you know, I think once you go out there, and you do realise when you go back, like I did with my mum's, you know, you spend all your life getting away from where you grew up, and then you realise at the end of it, oh my God, it weren't so bad. And you end up going back to that and appreciating it a bit more. And of course, where I grew up around Gray's Inn Road in King's Cross, it wasn't like it is now, you know, it was pretty edgy. So, well, you know.
But, so were you always musical at school then?
I think so. I mean, I never realised, it's people that tell me really that I went to school with, and they tell me these little stories of down in the music room, and I was always able to pick anything up and at least, you know, without studying, just see it and find a sound and get something out of it. It's just one of the things that I can do. I mean, I'm one of those annoying tappers and at dinners and things, and I look at objects and I can see the tone, and you know, I'm thinking, oh, I wonder what that. Yeah. And,
you so know, were you always into percussion at that point?
Oh yeah, always. I wanted to be a drummer more than anything, really, and I couldn't afford a drum kit. And my best friend at school, Stephen Gretsch, his name was, bless him, he's not here anymore. So we're 11, you know, and we're already from 11, 12, 13. He had rich parents. And they bought him the Top of the Range Premier kit and put it in his bedroom in a big mansion, you know. And you know, and he let me play on it. And I knew all the parts. Playing. And we used to mime as well, like we all did in whatever instrument. I used to mime the drums and guitar in front of the mirror. That typical thing, as we all did when we were growing up. And mime was the Yes album and Dark Side of the Moon. And I could play that along to the album when I was about 13 or 14, let's say, 15, whenever Dark Side came out, you know.
That's amazing. I mean, I loved, I had both those albums, actually.
Yeah.
Yes, were really underrated and being kind of a little bit forgotten in that entire period, because they were like one of the kind of antichrist bands after punk came along, weren't they? It's like too old fashioned now. But actually, I really liked the first Yes album. I thought it was fantastic.
Oh, amazing. I did. I thought it was brilliant, that album, with Bill Bruford and his tight snare. And, you know, the sound of it, even, I even thought at the time, it sounded like no other heavy-ish band or prog rock band. It was the bass that was so high and Chris Squire melodic, you know. And in a way, I guess, like Peter Hooks of this world, and that's, you know, where they playing like the guitar up the top as if it's a, the bass as if it's a guitar and that's the higher register. And that's what they did. It wasn't like any other sort of, if you call it, they're not a metal band, a prog rock band. It just felt it just felt unique. And yes, looking back, you know, still is. I think they're very underrated as in the whole prog rock thing. Besides the prog rock.
What were your other kind of musical influences around that time? Was it eclectic?
Very much.
Was it soul music?
Or? Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, Stevie Wonder 70s was my biggest influence, I would say. You know, that brought out the dance. Motown was big with me as a child growing up. Dad's side of the family, they lived sort of not far from Regent's Park. And we used to go there, and every year they had a party, just like family, close friends that lived nearby. And one of the guys there was Len, Uncle Len. He wasn't our uncle, it was Len Mitchell. And he was originally from Jamaica. So it was amazing what he brought to my life, let alone the party, because he had the rhythm. And we're listening to Stevie Wonder and all that. And then he'll go, can you do the limbo? And out he gets the broomstick and down we go. As a 9-year-old kid, I could go all the way down. So I felt
really impressed.
And then I remember dancing to the first record was Sugar. Da, 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 da. Oh, and I did it like, you know, like really naive 70s dancing.
And Millie and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, totally. So that was a big influence for me, and the Tighten Up records. But Stevie Wonder was a massive influence for me. That period between, well, I liked little Stevie Wonder, Fingertips and that early period, some brilliant sort of Tamla's stuff. But when he went into the electronica, if you like, you know, that was my thing. The groove of his electronica with those two fellas. What would they go, Morgulloff or something?
Morgulloff and Cecil.
Yeah, that's it.
They were
in,
what they call it, Tonto's Expanding Headband.
Yeah.
That was their band.
Yeah, that's it,
How weird that they became the go-to people for Stevie Wonder.
You know? Isn't it? But I remember, you know, even back then, sort of reading things that, is it the Mellotron you need lots of hands, and so they used to on a live mix like we used to, in fact, in the 80s when you
before
had no
before
of,
automation,
before automation, it was like various people going in and turning a fader up all around you. I remember sort of doing all that.
And
I
you know what? The accidents were just as good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, some of the accidents were better than what you planned.
Definitely. I always think that to this day, to be honest.
Yeah, we did on Penthouse and Pavement. Largely manual mixed. In particular, there was one desk also, even on Luxury Gap, where we were working at Air Studios and at Oxford Street, and their main desk, which was the most beautiful sounding desk ever I've worked on. It was a Neve, but it had no automation.
I remember that.
At all. So I don't. You probably worked in there as well.
Yeah, we did quite a bit there. Yeah,
it was the best sounding ever studio to me. Yeah. And
that corner one.
Yeah, the corner,
the
corner,
top.
That's right.
Right at the top.
I remember mixing some of the Luxury Gap. In fact, let me go. We had 10 hands on the desk.
Five people.
We had to do it in sections because it was too complex otherwise. But,
yeah.
You know, it's fucking amazing thinking about
it. Oh, yeah. God, the amount of money we spent, that was when it was a grand a day back in the early 80s.
Yeah, more sometimes.
God, in that studio.
Yeah. Lockout was like 1,300 or something.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money now, isn't it? That's like nearly
five. Oh, well, you can buy a whole studio setup for that, all the plugins.
But were you into, so have you always been into, have you always been into studio technology and stuff?
Yes and no. It interests me, but it bored the crap out of me. I'm not like you, Martin. I don't have that attention span, which is why I can't focus on one instrument or one thing. I love it, but it has to happen really quickly. Otherwise, I move on to the next thing. So to sit in, as it was back then, Well, you know, I'd always be around a studio, but there'd always be some pool table or something, or a swimming pool in Bahamas outside, because it would drive me nuts. And because we did literally spend a day on a snare sound once. Not we, the producer and whoever popped in throughout the day.
There are many examples of that. I mean, I remember when the Human League were doing their second album, actually in their studios, and at the same, Bob Blass was managing us at the same time, and he would come back with stories saying they've just spent 3 days trying to find a kick drum. And I'm going, the world of samplers isn't for the new Human League. You know, they've got to make, they're not very good at making decisions.
So I always believed that
the intuitive approach is best, and just believe, trust in your in what your first instinct is.
Yeah, always, always. That blink moment is something that I carry through my life. And I always, I'll spend, if I'm doing a session, I'll do it here now. I just set up my sax, you know, I know you can see me. You can't see me back home, listeners, but, you know, I've got a fairly big sort of apartment, you know, one of those high ceilings. And I've got a big table, all the things. And then in the corner is a little, you know, it's my sort of scrapbook area, I call it, even though what I record here, as long as people aren't making a noise or they're drilling next door, you know, it's fine. And I record things more like for guides and like demos, but they often end up getting used because that's what you need. Nowadays, the first thing you think about is the best thing.
Nowadays, the quality of demos that you can record is as good as, you know, anything, provided you've got a decent, decent mics and decent...
That's right. But I don't understand, like, looking back on that, I've thought about this since, spending a day and, like you say, 3 days getting a bloody kick drum or whatever it is, are they trying to... It seemed to me that people are just trying to copy what someone else has already done. Do you see what I mean? It don't make any sense to me.
I can't understand it myself. I mean, I am a big anti, anti sound library kind of thing when you're making tracks. I just go with whatever sounds kind of close in the first instance, build some stuff around it and replace it as I go along if I'm not happy with the quality of it. Yeah. Because everything every decision you make in the studio, it's like knitting a jumper, isn't it? You can't get like 10 rows in and then go, well, I'm going to change that. You know, it's like all decisions depend on all other
the next
web,
fish.
Isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
So yeah, you've got to. There was one Brian Eno thing that really had an impact on me, and he one of his things, you know, the oblique
strategies. Yeah, I love it.
Cards, and. One of them was like, throw away the first thing that you did on any track.
Yeah.
That was like, what is it? Try it.
But it's to take you away from it, isn't it?
Inspirational, man.
Yeah. Take you out of your own box, you know.
Yeah.
It's so much of that.
Into habits, don't we?
Yeah. And also, we're pushed into that. You know, I didn't want to be pushed into being a sax player. I was never a sax player. That was because I thought, well, I fancy something else. That was by default. And then all of a sudden, you're known as a sax player. I'm not just a sax player, to be honest with you. And I just think that there's a danger of being pigeonholed, not just by other people, but by yourself, because you're not challenging yourself. And I like the oblique strategies. His famous one, I guess he's right. Now, everyone, don't play. You can play any instrument but the one you play, you know. that's so much more interesting to me than trying to listen to see what sounds people are using. I do that if it comes to compression on dance tracks, because that changes a lot, doesn't it? Compression on dance tracks. I think that pumping is something that I am aware of that, and it gives it the edge. But as far as the sound is concerned, you know, everyone's catching up. I hate that.
Yeah, it's not a good thing. I think I'm fast forwarding a bit, but I'll come back to the earlier.
Yeah, go for it.
Were you very aware when you start to span out that you wanted to have a unique sound, in inverted commas, or were you just going, it's all about the songwriting?
I think initially, you know, when we were at school, this is what, 1976. I mean, I'll go quickly on that. You know, Gary and I were mates because of our love for guitar, even though we were in the same class at school. We hadn't really sort of linked up as friends as of yet until I saw him on a school assembly and was with another guy and was jealous. You know, he's like 12 or 13, right, something. I thought, oh, well, you want to do that? Play live. You know, I ended up doing it with him before we left school after we made up friends. We did an assembly together.
What were your band called then? I've got the coach.
Yeah, but before that, he was in a band, you see, in very early on. And that's how I got to meet Dagger, because he lived local. Right. I went to see the drummer, essentially, Ozzy. Chris Ostrowski was in my class. He was the drummer of this band. And I saw it. And then Steve Dagger, who lived not far from me in Holborn, we used to walk home after seeing his sort of gigs in the street in Camden, you know, in the Angel Islington, in fact. And we talk about it, me and Dagger. And then, you know, I remember Gary he didn't want to commit. He was studying maths or something. And, you know, he didn't want to know. And so he says is that what changed his mind was about taking it seriously to join a band. So I kept saying, look, let's join our own band. I play guitar, you do. We're always in each other's bedrooms. After a while, we became very close. But he wouldn't commit until we saw the Sex Pistols at Screen on the Green, which was 76 or 7. It's Sex Pistols, but before that, the Buzzcocks and the Clash, and it was amazing. We were in flares and Foster Grant glasses on, not dissimilar to these ones I'm wearing now, actually. But and that's it. We started the band, and we just did covers. Oh, Carol, don't let us steal your heart, that kind of stuff, you know, just to get our chops. The energy was there. Within no time, me and Gary were writing our own songs for the band. Cool. Until eventually, you know, it was obvious he was the best songwriter. I was the best musician, I think, but they all played. Yeah. Everyone played. I say best musician, that's not fair, but, you know, it's just they play their own instrument, but I could play all theirs as well, you know, if you see
exactly.
What I mean.
One second, I've just got to let my cat out because he's...
Yeah, I've got that as well. I'm wondering which she's going to kick
off. I love this local colour on the podcast anyway.
That's a way to do a podcast.
Yeah, we've got a plumber.
We've got pillows.
We've got a plumber in, and we're worried that the cat's going to run out. So my wife just chucked him into the room, and of course he can't get out. So anyway, back. Right, so this is fantastic. So you're in a band, and you start to think, maybe, just maybe, we can be a professional outfit. Were you doing like weddings and bar mitzvahs and all that
stuff? No, nothing. We never even considered that. It's weird you say that because it's so anathema to me that back then, you know, I mean,
just,
I guess
you
personally,
wanted to be your own identity.
Yeah, definitely. We were like, we wanted to be the next Beatles and the Stones or whatever.
Oh,
you know?
Wow. Okay.
You see what I mean? Yeah, we really thought. So that's what I'm saying. We went along that R&B route.
Yeah.
Tony immediately came out with this great voice, but it was American. And I remember I said to him, Tony, do you mind like, going a little bit like London? You're from London. Forget all that American stuff. He went, yeah, all right. And he changed like that. It was incredible. Wow. Yeah, he just got it like that. He just went to like a bit more Cockney, hello, but reeled that in a bit. And, you know,
yeah.
I got recordings of that stuff as well, really. Yeah.
Oh, my God, I'd love to hear that.
Rehearsing in the school drama room in 1977, six and seven, yeah.
I'd love to hear that. So at that time, of course, it's in the middle of the rise of punk. Did you ever consider being a punk band?
Well, it wasn't the rise of punk. It was kind of when it was already up there because as 1976, 77, it was in full flow.
Right, yeah.
We rocked up at the Screen on the Green Islington to see the Pistols.
Yeah.
And like people, there was already a tribe. And we weren't part of that because, like I say, I had Foster Grants on, Easy Rider, sunk classy.
Yeah.
And we all had flares. And, you know, it was like, oh my word, this is something, you know, I feel a bit out of place here. And Johnny Rotten was spitting at everyone. Oi, you effing this. Yeah. Find my effing tooth, because he knocked his tooth out with the microphone, you know. Not pretending he did. You know, but it was great.
No, John, like, yeah. He's a fan. Yeah.
It was Susie Sue afterwards and various other characters that went on to form bands. She was just dancing around in her, I don't know, I guess it was Ann Summers sort of leather gear, you know. Yeah. It was very akin to that. And that was it, really. We started rehearsing at school in a school drama room. John Keeble, I used to play drums, like I say. So yeah. I went down in my lunchtimes on my own and got the drum kit out in the one of the classes and bashed around for an hour. And John Keeble heard about this and he came down and, you know, we became friends because of it. And then I asked him if he fancied joining his band that I was putting together. And Tony, you know, Gary was up for it, although we hadn't done anything really together. And then Tony came up to me in the school common room corridor. He was very tall and I didn't really know him very well. He was one of those Jack the Lad characters at the time. He did have a very interesting short bomber leather jacket, you know, and it gave him an attitude because he had the collars up, you know, right up there. And they were quite big in the 70s collars, but he had them up anyway, you know. And he just said, "Here, are you looking for a singer for your band? I'll sing for you." And I just looked up and I was kind of impressed by his front, if anything. I thought, yeah, and the leather jacket.
He's not short, is he?
No, not at all. You know, and we of course became great friends.
He always had a, you know, he clearly is just able to sing. But what were his influences? It's quite crooner.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah,
and, don't mean that as an insult, by the way. Glenn's a bit like that as well.
Yeah,
and it's like, what did we grow up with? I was talking to Richard Hawley, and he's going, well, his dad used to perform he was a musician and used to play the working men's clubs and do all that kind of Duane Eddy stuff. And that's where he got his taste for it. I'm just wondering. I mean, I'm going to really interview Tony and ask him about this. But
yeah, well, look, I know that it was Frank, really, more than anyone.
Really?
Frank Sinatra. Yeah, we became
parents, didn't it? Actually,
yeah, totally. Yeah, and you know, it's sad now. His mum, Josie, is the only sort of parent left, you know. And I saw her 2 weeks ago. She came to one of my gigs in London, as she does, and Tony's sister and son. And it's a real still family affair, you know, because Tony's mum and my mum were best mates.
Right. So
even though Tony and I might have fallen out over the years, we're good pals again now, but you know what bands are like. You know, my mum and her never fell out and we never discussed anything. And, you know, just family is family and we kept that going. But he was very much into the crooner thing. He would even sort of sing like they do in that delay, you know, with known Spandau songs until one of us would look and go, "You sure about that, Tony?"
Oh my god, yeah, it's funny, you know, when he did the thing with Martin Fry when they were on the Royal Albert Hall, and he was doing various cover versions and stuff, and I'm going. Some of it was fantastic. I mean, you can never argue with his technical ability. He's just a really great singer.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's sometimes his taste is like a little bit too out.
Not yours.
Yeah.
Not necessarily mine.
Please patter between us all.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's a give and take with anything. I'm sure, you know, I can play things and I'm a cheap date in a way in the band because I just can play a lot of stuff and congas and all this stuff. But they put up with me. Yeah, and I'm sure I could get on
I don't want any sulfur.
Well, they did. They don't anymore. I've had enough of it.
Do you play keyboards?
You know, it's really weird that because I nearly did very early on, you know, Spandau got. This is as soon as we went to the Blitz and sort of heard all this electronica, and we was very much, you know, like I say, R&B, doom, cat. And then that's the groove, isn't it? And then dance groove is literally dunk, 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 as you know, four beats on the floor, we call it. And I Oh, shit. You know what? Sorry, mate. I forgot the question.
All right. Did
edit that out.
Keyboards.
Yeah. So at that point, we all chipped in for a keyboard, and it was a CS10 Yamaha. So we could afford
on the drip.
Yeah. On the drip, that cost us 6 months to a year. We had, you know, we're on the dough half of it.
Yeah,
it
of course.
I had good jobs. We all had sort of decent jobs, but, you know, sort of stopped working at IPC magazine. I was a senior copy and makeup clerk, but I thought, oh my God, it's just like you don't want to do it. Great job, but you don't want to do it. So gave up that for a year to focus on Spandau. Talk about a year and a half before we signed a contract, you know.
That's right. But
during all that time and earlier was I played with an Oberheim. I took it home and I loved all that Oberheim sound. And I really would like to do keyboards. But I thought it's a lot of study and I won't be front line anymore. See, you know what I mean? I can't jump around on stage if I'm trapped there. I made a decision to play congas.
Mate.
Yeah, I played congas though. That stuck me up on the rise at the back.
Oh, yeah.
But I still made sure I come out and went on walkabouts, you know
what
I mean?
Yeah, fair enough.
With the sax. So I was only a keyboard player for a little while, but I can program. And I did play piano for a while in the 90s when I had one in Ibiza. Just an upright. So I used to write tunes on that and whatever. But I made a decision about the keyboard that it's an instrument that I don't know very much about. So when I pick a guitar up, you go to these different sort of chord changes and progressions. And I wanted to get out of that. I wanted to rip it up like Brian Eno would.
Yeah.
And so I purposely don't learn the piano or the keyboard too well, but I can get around it. And then, like Bowie was like that. Look at the beginning of Changes. It's just those four notes on the C interspaced, moved up the keyboard, as you know.
Exactly. Well, I don't read or write music, so everything I do is just by ear, you know.
Totally.
But it's not stopped us writing some songs.
Yeah, didn't stop Paul McCartney either.
Stop Paul McCartney or Stevie Wonder for that matter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true. I'll just.
Oh, yeah. He probably knows, but I mean, he can't.
He can't read it, can he?
So.
No, he can't. But I mean, yeah, he has a deeper vision, though, doesn't he? I mean, blind people tend to have something we haven't got. Yeah.
So do you prefer, you obviously prefer writing on guitar then?
It's my go-to instrument. I'm a guitarist first and foremost because I couldn't afford a drum kit when I was a child, and you know, bearing in mind I used to drum along on upturned cardboard boxes, like with knives, before I could get some drumsticks.
I bet you were popular with.
Yeah, I know. But I could do all of like the shadows because I used to be like what you did when anyone grows up, they go around and raid people's record collections wherever they are, you know. So I'd go through that, and my uncle Jim, I used to sort of get dropped off to just look after myself, you know, whilst my mum held down two jobs, if I'm honest. But, you know, while I was there, I just searched for music, and at that point it was the Shadows, and I mimed to all of Little B, which is and Big B, and could do it as well, including the bass drum, which I pretended was in front of me, to Brian Bennett's solo and everything. I remember telling a friend of mine this really recently, a couple of years ago, about how Brian Bennett, the drummer from the Shadows, kind of influenced me, and it made me think I've got rhythm, you know, to be able to hold down what he was doing, a great drummer. And I was telling my mate Willie Morgan, he used to play with Manchester United in the 60s, 70s, good pal with George Best. And I was telling him, he goes, oh, he's a mate of mine, hold on a minute. And within 10 seconds, he's gone, here, Steve. I'm going, what do I say to him? He was a bit of a hero, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's what happens, isn't it, when we get fairly popular people, you get to meet your sort of people you grew up that held to a very high esteem, you know.
I actually worked with I got Hank Marvin in to do some guitar on the first BEF album, and I got him to do the dance as well.
Really?
Ooh, yeah, remember the dance?
Really? Yeah, of course, the steps. Yeah, I met him once actually in Perth.
He's
lives in Perth, doesn't he?
He's lovely.
Yeah, they're all lovely, them lot, really.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to digress. Sorry, you know, I mean, you must have been absolutely distraught about Tina.
Tina.
Had such a such a big hand in resurrecting her career, mate. Didn't you? You did.
I was quite distraught because we were good mates, you know. And she's such a lovely person and, you know, a real rarity. Somebody who's absolutely at the very top of the tree, who is so was so good that she didn't have any airs and graces at all. She was just like us chatting now, you know.
And, I met her once, agree with that,
So, it's very sad, but I'm going to do an actual special podcast.
Good.
Because you must have, with reminiscences of people and me and Glenn, you know, when we first met her and went to her house in Hollywood, and she made us like, she was so polite and like saying, we're English, so we can I get you some tea and biscuits and a crumpet, you know. I'm going, what the fuck's going on? Two different council houses, in Sheffield.
Tea crumpets. More like a pint and a pie.
more of that to come. But
good. That's
so
good.
So let's talk about football.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, I'm a Wednesdayite, so I'm very happy at the moment.
Yeah, cool. And I've got another friend who's a Wednesdayite, so I'm happy.
It was incredible. I was at Wembley the other day, and it's just one of the best days of my life. Anyway, Spurs. Tell me about Spurs.
Oh, it's not much. They got, you know, I think we're all fed up with a Spursy. Your nature, you know what I mean? I mean, it seems to be like a disease, don't it? But I was lucky this season, and in the My second team is obviously living in Brighton. It's Brighton.
Right. Yeah, of course. And I
bumped into, I went out for dinner with a friend of mine, actually Steve Harley. Sorry, a name drop. But we were
Please, that's what this is all about.
Yeah. So, me and Steve, we've done gigs together and he jumps up at my gigs and vice versa. And I've done a couple of tours with him, you know, and we get on very well. And his cousin, he came along to this dinner, and he goes to Brighton all the time. So we struck up conversation, and in the end, a couple of weeks later, we went to see Brighton. It was only about a month ago. They beat Wolves like 6-1 or nil, wasn't it? And I was there, right? We were there. It was the most amazing afternoon. So and there's no trouble with like, I don't think there is so much football these days, is there? But it was really like, you know, what you would imagine a rugby game, families smiling, chatting. You go in there and there's a lovely bar, walk down, there's your seat. And we had great seats, right halfway line. It's a small stadium, isn't it? The Amex, really. Yeah. So you can still see people's faces even on the pitch. But all the commentators were in front of us, and there was a replay at a TV screen. So we were there watching the match, and then literally 10 foot away we could watch the replay. I don't think it gets any better than that. And I made a decision. I'm going to go the rest of the season. I am going with the Seagulls because Spurs can do one this season.
It's nice. Like Chelsea, it's even worse, isn't it?
Yeah.
A little note on Brighton. I want to give them some kudos for a few years ago. I went down with Wednesday. And for the away fans, they make the effort to get in a special beer from whichever team's area it is.
Cool.
And also some indicative food from that area. So they had meat pies and Henderson's relish from Sheffield. Yeah, and I just thought that's really clever and thoughtful, because people from that moment on will go away and say, you know, that Brighton club, they've got their head screwed on. They don't treat people like cattle, away fans. They treat them well. And because they treat them well, everybody behaves well.
That's it. It's really...
It's simple.
Monkey see, monkey do. You used to say
exactly. Yeah. So let's go back to your time in Ibiza, because you were doing a lot of kind of dance stuff with different people, weren't you?
Yeah.
And so house music and Ten City and
Frankie
Knuckles and my mate Angie Brown.
Angie Brown, loved her.
M17.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
She was our backing singer with Billy Godfrey for.
Oh no, Billy!
She's great, Billy. Yeah, she's amazing. Them two were our backing singers for the first 5 years when we started performing live in the '90s.
Wow.
We had to sack Angie in the end, not because she wasn't any good, because she was brilliant, but because she was so big a character she'd kind of like dominate the stage, and it was like, not, we're not bothered about sharing the limelight, but it was like, and then it turned into like she didn't really learn the backing vocal lyrics properly, so we caught her a couple of times.
There's an excuse.
Just mouthing the lyrics, not singing, or not even mouthing the right lyrics. And then like the start, the intro to Temptation, which is quite long, it would turn into, she'd forgotten what she was meant to do, so she'd just go woof woof woof, and all this stuff. And we went, Ange, I think it's time we went our separate.
Yeah,
we're still mates. We're still mates. I love Ange.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, she's
yeah.
lovely.
So really. You worked with Jeremy.
I remember. Well? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is when I got to Ibiza. I think it was 2009 Spandau I got together. So it was a couple of years before then. I already put compilations together. I've, you know, Made in Ibiza was a double album, Chills and Thrills, which was homegrown sort of producers on Ibiza. And people that live on the island, because I lived there for 12 years. My kids grew up there. My family's half Spanish. That's
right.
My kids and that. So I went around the island and just found all the producers and musicians and compiled a couple of CDs, actually, for Savannah as well. I did one for them, which was representing, you know, the talent of Ibiza. And I loved it. It was a labor of love. But then after that, I hooked up with Head Candy, which is part of Ministry of Sound. And for a year or two, I went nearly every weekend around the world somewhere with DJs, various different DJs. Wow. Could be Jeremy Healy.
And you played live with them, percussion and...
Yeah, I did initially. I remember with Jeremy Healy, I hired a car. I wasn't getting paid very much either. It was really because I loved it, even though I could have done with a dough at the time, I can tell you. But yeah. I thought, I really want to do this. So I hired percussion, I hired a car, drove to Blackpool, met Jeremy Healy, you know, and haven't seen him since or before in the Blitz, of course. But and just I just dive in there and jump in and muck in, and it's all improv. And I love that. But unless, of course, like in Creamfields or wherever, I'm up a speaker stack, thousands of people. All you can hear is the groove, a little bit of the groove. Right. But then when the actual track kick, and I'm going, you got to hit like a phrase and repeat it. It's not like pop. It's the opposite way of thinking. You see what I mean? It's not like really quick and condensed. It's spread it all out, even though it's boring. Right. You know what I mean? But that's what people like, that sort of repetition in your playing. And then they notice you. It's very weird, whether it's percussion or sax. So I'll be up a speaker stack, totally exposed, can't climb any higher. And then the track kicks in and it's in a completely different key to the one I've been playing in. It's thanks a lot. This is, in a way, it's mixers, it's DJs that are not very musical. Do you see what I mean?
They're more about the rhythm,
Yeah, it is. But, you know, and I did that for a couple of years, and then Spandau reformed in 2009. And I was ready. I was, my chops were all up to speed. I was playing all the time. Me and K-Class played in Abramovich's club in Moscow. I went to places I'd never even been. Yeah, Cairo. I never went there with Spandau. I've never been back since, you know, a couple of days there, private parties and whatever. So it was really, that was really good and timely for me to be up to speed for when Spandau reformed, you know.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm dodging about the timeline a bit here, but
okay.
I just want to go back to the scene in Soho when you started Spandau and when you were first successful, and maybe tell me a little bit about the launch night for Spandau. Was it Le Kilt?
It was the Blitz we played first. Blitz. We did a couple of gigs at the Blitz. Steve Strange, we're talking about late 1979. So we'd gone to, me and sort of Steve Dagger and Gary and then Martin, we started going to Billy's, which was around the corner but became too small. So Steve Strange and Rusty Egan, you know, of course.
Who is in the middle of everything.
You know, I know. I wonder that. I was looking for your reaction there, you know, because
I love people,
Oh, yeah, he's great. I mean, you know, he's got on my nerves so much over the years, but so have I him. And we've lived together in Ibiza, like, over the summer, God, just doing gigs together. Yeah. God, I went away to the UK. When I came back, he'd been kicked out of his flat because he was denounced in the paper. Not his fault. It's just that he's a bit Mutt and Jeff. He's a bit deaf, isn't he? Right. I go round, when I'm playing, I go round where he is and I go, oh my word, the volume takes the top of your head off. It really does. So he didn't realise that when he was working, like he does, he's always working, Rusty, like music and what have you. It was so loud at stupid O'Clock, they denounced him in the local paper and he got kicked out. Yeah, it's so funny. But so he had a lot to do with it, of course, in the early days. Him and Steve, they moved to the Blitz, somewhere bigger. All that electronica, you know, he brought Being Boiled in there. And I thought was incredible, you know. So it's not just Rusty. He was at the time just playing music by other creatives like yourself, Mark.
Daniel Miller and all that.
Yeah, stuff. I loved all that. I mean, Warm Leverette for me was like, still is a killer, killer. I love it. That was more influential, I think, Daniel Miller stuff than anything. Yeah. I mean, it was always Dum Dum Boys and, like, you know, mix it with Bowie, mix it with, you know, this sort of Wehrmacht. Is it Wehrmacht? Wehrmacht, isn't it? You know, that in-between war Berlin cabaret culture.
Yeah.
The Nazis spoil. It was so good.
You know what the interesting thing is, Steve? I've just been commissioned to do a soundscape for a room in Madame Tussauds in Berlin, based on there's a TV series called Babylon, which is in German.
I know it's really on the tube. Every time I go down the U-Bahn,
they're recreating the bar from that scene, from that period.
In
Madame Tussauds with famous people from that period. And we're doing a soundscape with all the authentic music from that
period. Do that, don't you? That's something I've talked about with in the past. Your sort of understanding of soundscapes and that is incredible.
And how that informs more traditional writing.
I mean, let me know when it is, because I'm always in Berlin, as you know, spend half my time there. And it's home for me a little bit, Berlin. And
it'll be Madame Tussauds. Yeah. It could be next year.
Right.
I'll let you know about it. Maybe if they have a launch.
You're not going to Berlin at all to do it.
Well, we have to go to install it all. Yeah,
that's what I mean.
So I'll be out there. I love Berlin. It's great.
Yes.
Okay. Where were we? Yeah. So tell us about the. So we're at the Blitz, and you did some couple of gigs there, right?
Well,
did you get spotted there to get signed up?
Yeah. Well, it started there. Yeah. I mean, we actually were called Gentry, right? We couldn't come up with another name. We were part sort of the cut, the Makers. You know, the Makers, I remember we needed a name for this band. And I remember living sort of Chapel Street way. I mean, I'm in that, you know, where Chapel Street is at the top, the Angel. Angel, where there's loads of shops and buses and whatever. Now there, I looked behind me and there was a shop called Homemakers, and I thought, that's a good name, the Makers. It's like the creation or something, like high numbers, really 60s. So we were very much like that. And I was doing art when I was at school, and I was screen printing T-shirts. And Gary heard about that, and he came down. We did all these screen printing. You can still see that pop art. Most of it is mine. Gary did one, but, you know, Tony's got mine. Yeah. It's all the designs I did, really. And from that, that point on, we came from the Makers, because Rich Kids had come out, and who was the other one? There was Secret Affair, and they kind of like were a little bit, people were talking about them. And it seemed like this power pop thing, which was punk with melody, if you like, you know, was someone else who kind of claimed it. So we were kind of, wasn't our thing.
Hang out with us and Spiz and all that.
Well, we sort of ended up stumbling across, Steve Dagger did, to be fair. He stumbled across Billy's, And Shagoramas, even before that, there was an interesting crowd. Yeah, remember Shagoramas?
No.
I went once or twice.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was, I don't know much about it because, you know, Steve went down it. It was because of the people that went down there. It's like disillusioned ex-punks, you know, that were really peacock punks. They wanted to, people wanted to dress up, not be told, not go along with that.
There
destroy, everything's destroyed. I'm not going to your world then. We'll find another one to inhabit. And that's it. And it was really that buzziness that was going on down the bottom of the Billies for me, which then was the Blitz. And Steve, we invited people to Halligan's rehearsal studio where we rehearsed alongside Iron Maiden and Madness. Yeah, wow. Different times. But and we had like invited a few of our friends down there, Steve Strange, all the people that were going to the Blitz. It turned up, it would now look like a fancy dress, but everyone was where it was like brilliant at the time, you know. And we just did a few numbers in front of them live in the rehearsal place. And we said, Gentry, please come to our blah, blah, blah. And people thought we were calling them Gentry. And we thought, hang on, we can get away with this. We need a better name. And Bob Elms came up with that. He saw it written on the toilet wall, Spandau Ballet. Yeah.
God bless him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's how we got a name. So we did, we went to the Blitz. That it was only a few weeks later. Steve said, it's the Blitz year party. No, what would it be? I'm not sure. But it was a birthday party. So I think it'd been open a year, perhaps. And we were the band, the only band going around. So we played there and we did it again. And people like Chris Blackwell from Island Records, he immediately offered us a deal, but we didn't take, we didn't take that. Steve Dagger thought we could get, you know, a better deal, which we did. I think he signed someone else of merit actually and focused on them. Might have been Grace Jones, not sure. Yeah, so we played there a couple of times. You do know the story of, it always makes me chuckle, really, with Boy George, who was, you know, he got caught stealing. He was the hat check girl.
I didn't know that. Tell me.
Yeah, oh, he was working in taking people's hats and coats until he got caught stealing, you know, and it was banned. So Steve Strange, he was a dear, dear friend of mine.
I love Steve.
Yeah, he used to say, "Oi, O'Dowd, get out of it." In fact, George told me this. We were his pallbearers at the funeral, George and I said, "What are you doing here in the back of the limo going to, you know, with the following the Steve's remains, you know, and coffin?" And I said, "What are you doing here? You hated each other." He sort of grinned. It was a love-hate thing. They had a lot of respect. But he goes, "George," he said, "yeah, he used to tell me. I used to try and sneak in and he'd see me up the road. And he'd shout out, 'Oi, O'Dowd, go away, you're not coming in.'" And he shout, we did a photo session in the squat where they all lived, you know, the Warren Street squat. It was he shouted down the stairs. This is in the middle of the afternoon. He just got up and he, in his dressing gown, George shouted out, "Yeah, you still got that singer singing for you? I can sing better than him." And like, and John Keeble shouted that, "Well, form a band then." Famous last words, all right. Culture Club, here we go.
That's amazing.
Oh, it's so, loads of stories, yeah.
So two things, right? One is, what were the first few songs that you wrote? And was, to cut a long story short, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, me and Gary used to share the writing from like 76 for a few years, but they were very much the sort of R&B direction, you know, as I was saying. And then when we got to the Blitz, we changed the groove. And Gary was suddenly fired up. He came out with, to cut long story short. In fact, it was we thought we were going to invest in the synthesizer, go that direction, and so we did. And he just took it home and got to cut long story short out of it. Not bad,
right.
Yeah. And it became very apparent that you know, he was the best by far. Well, he was by far the best songwriter. It was his strength. So I stopped writing. In fact, I stopped writing just before we recorded our album.
Damn,
I'm gutted about that. But his songs were better, there's no doubt about it.
Damn it. I'm not going to go into the split and everything because it's it's all been well documented, and yeah, cool, frankly,
sick and tired of it all.
I'm tired of talking about it. But just for the record, who are you getting on with at the moment? Are you getting on with everyone?
I'm the only one who's in contact with all of them. I'm the only one.
Right. You're like the kind of Henry Kissinger of the band.
Well, I mean, everyone tries to claim that. I ain't going to go there. It's nothing to do with bringing everyone together. It's me sort of really wanting to remember the good times. So I've had to put all that to rest. Just so, because when people, I noticed over the years, when people say Spandau Ballet, that has a different meaning to them than it does to me. Even if they're standing in front of me, you know, once those words reach my ears, I make my judgment and my face drops. And it doesn't it, you know, I had to get rid of that because there's not, they're gushing, of course. And I thought that was wrong. So I thought I've got to deal with this, not just for other people, but for me as well, because I felt bitter. I feel bitter all the time. And I did.
You can't be doing that. I always say to people, don't, especially as we get a bit older, don't let bitterness take your life over because it's just a corrosive thing in your life.
It
makes you miserable.
It does.
It doesn't help anyone, you know.
And then before you know it, people die, you know, and like we do.
Well, I went, like, to, I went. What, to spa-
yeah, I, why I didn't to, I say that tell that person I really love them? You know what I mean?
I was at Spike's funeral. I was so sad.
I can't keep up. I really can't. It breaks my heart. It's just, you know, every day there's someone I know.
Well, let's just keep on keeping on, you know.
We know a lot of people, and you know that if you know a lot of people and have great relationships, then you've got some great joy and good times together. But it's like having an animal eventually, and they're going to pass. It might be yourself. You never know. But just enjoy it as much as you can. And I ain't going to stop making friends with people because I enjoy people.
No, and stuff. Yeah, the one unifying thing, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, well, I am really, but
no.
Is throughout the years, whenever, you know, we've met and been in nice situations, you are a genuinely positive force, you know, apart from being a great musician. And so I give you full kudos for that because
it
needs people like that.
I'm glad I don't come across as miserable. I'll gotta say, Mark, last thing, I'm blowing smoke up yours. I went to see, for everyone listening, went to see Heaven 17. It was only a week or so ago.
Yeah,
just literally at the end of my gigs in London, I thought, as knackered as I was, I thought, I've got to we gotta go and see this. It's local. We gotta support the boys and the girls.
Absolutely.
I loved it. And it was, for me, it was just what the doctor ordered in a way. But I'm not saying I was sick or anything, but you know, it's like putting together so many things and this gig, and there's a lot of admin that I do as well. And the best bit is the stage bit. But you gotta do it, right? You know, you gotta know what's going on. So I did that, and then all of a sudden, I was actually watching this fantastic show, you know, and I had nothing to do with it. It wasn't mine. Oh, no. It was like yours, and it was
no
all
responsibility.
Yours. Camaraderie that came across and everything.
Yeah, we've kind of nailed that to an extent now. I mean, it's taken us a long time to get there. But, you know, we didn't play live for ages, but, I mean, we've been doing it 25 years now. So it's taken us that long to build our audience.
Yeah, but it's great. I mean, it really is. You've got that, that's, you know, that camaraderie and Mickey Tate, you know, that's part of my gigs.
Part of the football thing for me as well, you know. Yeah, I grew up with, and we used to hang out with the Wednesday footballers, and they are brutal, you know, the kind of things they say about each other.
Bit like Spandau Ballet. Yeah. we destroyed each other.
Exactly. It turns a bit serious at times, that's the thing. Okay, so we're down to the smash hits questions now.
Okay.
So what's your favourite film?
It always was, not just because it's electronically yours, it was A Clockwork Orange.
Was it?
Yeah,
you're totally the only person who's ever said that.
You're kidding me.
Apart from me, obviously.
Yeah, it was massive influence for me. That I was really into Wendy Carlos.
Yeah, me
and
too.
Walter Carlos before he became Wendy. And not so much Switched on Buck, but when I heard a bit of the theme tune, because it was banned, wasn't it, when we were kids growing up. And always fascinated about it. Everyone wanted to see it. So I managed to get like, you know,
a snide VHS.
Yeah, over the years and watched that. And I think it was the backing track that really opened my eyes as to classical. I liked classical music and I like it to this day because of A Clockwork Orange.
To a certain extent. Yeah. To me as well. Did he ever get a copy of the original electronic soundtrack that he wrote for the entire film?
No way. Is it different to the one?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You can't get it. It's not on digital platforms. You have to order it directly from Wendy Carlos's website.
Oh, right. I've got to do this.
It's fucking outstanding.
Can we swear on this, Sheldon?
Oh, you can fucking do what you fucking want.
I mean, you bleep that one out. Oh, let me just blow more smoke out there. I just realised that's where Heaven 17 get their name from.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
that's it. The Heaven 17.
That's it.
In the record shop.
Yeah. What's your favourite TV show?
I don't know why The Prisoner just popped in my head. Maybe because we're talking about that. I don't have a favourite one. I don't like all the baking cakes things, even though my daughter is a professional chef and she's actually going to be on. She's got a Channel 4 thing coming out and Netflix, actually. Yeah, it's a cool 5-star chef. I think I can mention it now. I don't know when this is going out. But, she's not tied down to anything, though. She's one of those sort of... They're both creatives, my kids, you know. She's
right, in that's cooking, great. Sort of, she's must chefing, be very proud.
Yeah, they really are. They look after themselves. And as long as they've got studio space and green screens and things like that. Ooh, you know?
Bloody hell.
Great. Yeah. I love
it. Okay, what's your favourite book?
My favourite book. Good grief. I've got so many books next to my bed. I've got your one next to my bed, by the way.
Have you? Have you read it?
I bought it. I haven't. I've got loads of books and it's to read in the future. Because my attention span for sitting, it's terrible, really. I need to read novels. Stop studying, because it is.
Well, my book is available at all good bookshops, it's not a masterpiece, but it's quite readable and interesting.
Well, that's what you need, isn't it? You just want something that people can understand. Yeah. But I should have brought it along to the show. Would you sign it?
I'd love to. Yeah. There's an audiobook version as well, which is quite funny because that was one of the most painful experiences doing an audiobook. Never, ever agree to do it, ever.
Really, yeah.
I will never do another one.
You can't sign them.
It took three solid days of eight hours of recording to record it and probably 500 drop-ins. Oof. It was so difficult. I had no idea. Anyway.
So I didn't tell you my favourite... whatever, there doesn't matter, does it? Book, let's say yours, the one that I'm going to love.
All right. Oh God, you're a professional. Favorite band?
Stevie Wonder. Well, it was Stevie Wonder 70s. You know, I've loved all that Prince, soul music, massive soul music fan. But then I love prog rock, as we talked about Floyd and all those kind of bands. Yeah. Even Gentle Giant was in there at one point. Good Focus. Lord. Do you know what is a great album? You probably like it. It's called Café Exil. And I've looked for it in Berlin when I was there. And it doesn't really exist anymore. It's a restaurant. But it's where when Bowie and Iggy were in Berlin, where they used to frequent. And it's all electronic music from the 70s, really. I don't even think there's anything on the 80s, maybe touched on it.
Right.
It's brilliant. Café Exil. And you'd be amazed at because as Spandau were, we were never an electronic band. We just had a synthesizer, you know, and went.
Right.
It wasn't so much like, certainly wasn't like you guys electronically. But we always had a drummer. Bands did. They had drummers, like acoustic drums going through, because I'd guess the sequencing hadn't been sort of nailed down yet. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I love it. That's what Café Exil was all about.
Oh, I'll look into that. What's your favourite synth?
Oh, my word. Oh, I'm just trying to think. You know what? I'm going to just say the CS10, because that was the first one that changed, helped to change our direction, including our name.
Amazing.
Yeah,
right. Well, that's it. Steve, hey. Could go on for hours because we both love the sound of our own voices. Yeah. And we get on well, and we're just good mates. So, fantastic! This will be coming out soon. And
Let me know, and I'll
can't
I'll
wait, mate. And stuff. And what's your next thing? Plug your next thing.
Oh God, I'm going to America with my. It's the Sleeves at the moment. Me and the Sleeves, my band, because I love a band environment. I miss all the piss taking and all that. Yeah. So I didn't want to like Steve Norman and band. I mean, I sing, as you know, and do all the other things I did. But I promote the characters in the band, you know, the personalities. And, you know, of course, the banter, everyone gives back. So there's a few, got a few things. What have I got? Cricket in Wales.
Right.
That's coming up. I'd like to give that a little plug. I'm not sure which date in June it is, unless I can get it up. We're going to America in July.
All right, cool.
There it is. There, 24th, I think it is, in Cricket. That must be that. Cricket in Wales.
Steve, I'm going to have to go, mate. I've got delivery I've got to deal with.
I can see, yeah.
All right, man. I will see you really.
Lovely chatting with him, Mark. Yeah.
All right.
Steve, some very interesting stories about his time with Spandau and the Blitz Club and all that stuff. I hope he enjoyed all that. I certainly did. We could have probably talked for hours just from our joint experiences, let alone anything else. Anyway, it's lovely to talk to him. How are you all? If you want to send me any ideas for the podcast, for guests or for sections and anything like that, the address is electronicallymartin@gmail.com. If you want to contribute towards the Patreon page, it's patreon.com/electronicallyhours. Really appreciate any help you can give financially towards keeping the podcast going. It costs me time and money to do so, obviously. Need some help if we can, or sponsorship if anyone's interested. That's it for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. Another great guest next week. Bye.